Hello and welcome to CSDW's podcasts and broadcasts. This is Writer's Talk. I'm Doug Dangler. I'm fortunate to be joined today in the studio by Dr. Peter Mansour, who has 26 years of distinguished military service and he rose to be a brigade commander in Iraq and the executive officer for General David Petraeus. He's now the Raymond E. Mason Jr. Chair of Military History at The Ohio State University. His research interests include modern U.S. military history, World War II, and counterinsurgency operations. He's written two books. The latest is Baghdad at Sunrise, an exceptionally detailed firsthand account of his time in Iraq in 2002 and 3 as commander of the 1st Brigade, 1st Armored Division, the Ready First Combat Team. Welcome, Dr. Mansour.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Sure. Let's start with the very detailed nature of your text. I'm curious. You kept a combat journal, I read, and you relied on many sources in the book, which you're evidenced by the bibliography in the back. Your level of detail even extends to noticing when you were getting spaghetti dinners too frequently. Now, I often can't recall what I've had for lunch the day before. Just how detailed were your journals prepping for this book?
Well, first, I really had no intention of writing a book when I went to Iraq. What I wanted to do was record my experiences for my kids and then my grandkids and maybe have these journals that get passed down as family lore. So it was a wide variety of things, both human interest and more substantial in terms of problems that we had to overcome. When I got back, though, and I read through the journals, I realized that no one was going to be able to make sense of them because they were very scattershot, and there were actually two journals that I kept. So I decided that at that point that I would turn this into a family manuscript and write the history of my biography, my memoirs of that time in Iraq. But as I began writing, I realized I had a larger message that I thought was good for a wider audience. And that's when I decided to actually write a book. And that's when I began pulling in more than just what was in my journals.
It's funny because you give a not always flattering account of what happened there and of some senior military decisions and presence. You describe the aftermath of one attack as, quote, everyone was doing what needed to be done except for the large number of colonels and lieutenant colonels from CPA and CJTF who showed up to help, but merely added unneeded mass to an already overcrowded scene. I'm wondering if descriptions like that have led to responses from any senior officials who said, we were there helping, we weren't unneeded mass.
Well, because I don't name names, of course, they can remain anonymous. I've received, on the whole, very positive feedback from my peers in the military, my colleagues, who I worked with. Every now and then you have someone who says, well, this piece of it, I had a different perception of what was going on, or I didn't really agree with your characterization of this CPA policy, Coalition Provisional Authority. But on the whole, the response has been very, very positive, and people have said this is the book that needed to be written.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, when you say something like the CPA, the Provisional Authority, it's interesting because you provide a glossary of military acronyms at the front of the book, which is especially helpful for somebody like me who has very little military background. In writing this memoir, did you feel a lot of influence from that? Did you start off with one sort of acronym version and then open it up for a wider audience?
I actually wanted this to be a work for the general public, so I wrote it and as open as I could with as few military terms as possible. Mm-hmm. And then when I read through it again, I said, wow, there's a lot of military terms in there. So I reduced it even more and spelled more of them out and whatnot. And then I was feeling pretty good about myself, and I sent the manuscript to the editor. And the editor, Dan Heaton, who's a University of Illinois graduate, works for Yale University Press, really a great editor, and he did a masterful job. But he sent a note back. And he said, if Spanish and English is Spanglish, then Army and English is Armish, and you write in Armish. And he did an even better job in turning my Army speak, if you will, into the King's English and helped make it even more broadly accessible. Even after that, I was thinking, well, okay, now it's ready for the general public. I've gotten a lot of feedback saying, boy, I'm glad you provided that glossary up front, but you really use a lot of acronyms, and this would be hard to understand otherwise. and I thought I had dumbed it down a lot.
for a lay audience.
Yes, I guess it says something about Army culture and the way we use specialized terms.
Well,
here's the tension there, and that is I wanted it to be authentic enough that military people could read it and say, yes, this is an authentic account of what happened, and yet be accessible to the general public. If you dumb it down too much, the military people will just dismiss it as being elementary. And so that was the fine line I was walking.
In this case, you're really writing a piece of the public military historical record. And how did that affect you as you wrote about it?
Well, there was a variety of audiences I was looking at. There was the general public, who I wanted to inform, you know, what went on that first year, because there was a lot of misinformation in the media, people who were writing about Iraq who hadn't really spent a lot of time over there. And I wanted to let the American people know this is what happened that first year, at least in one corner of Iraq. Another audience then was my fellow military officers, who I felt really needed to come to grips with counterinsurgency warfare and what warfare in the 21st century is going to be like and the kind of things that we needed to study and discuss and the kind of organizational changes we needed to implement in order to be ready to fight these kind of wars, which I think are going to be with us for some period of time. And then the final audience was the policymakers in Washington, who, quite frankly, I think, made strategic errors of the first order in going into Iraq in the first place, and then in the way some of the decisions they made once we were on the ground. And that was another audience that I was trying to reach. And the manuscript has to then cater to each one of those audiences in different ways. So there are things like humorous episodes with spaghetti and shakes and so forth. But then there's also some really serious discussion of what went wrong and what we need to do to fix it.
And there's a part at the end of the book, the final chapter is called Reflections, and it's sort of the lessons learned portion of it that as I was reading through it reminded me that you had written, had a part in rewriting the counterinsurgency manual for the Army, and I thought this is really probably something that also grew out of that experience and writing about that, because it seems to me that a lot of this stuff, as you've described it, is a big switch from the U.S. military going from having this ability to come in and wipe out sort of do regime change pretty easily, but then figuring out what to do afterwards is a problem.
Yeah, I was what Conrad Crane, the principal author of Field Manual 3-24 Counterinsurgency, calls a secondary author. I helped to edit the first draft of the document, and then I made some substantive contributions to the final version. That was a good experience, but I had been thinking about counterinsurgency warfare for a while. Ever since my days at Ohio State, when I took a class in Revolutionary Warfare with my PhD advisor, Alan Millett. In fact, the education I received here at Ohio State in that regard was every bit or even better than my professional military education, which tended to ignore counterinsurgency warfare, revolutionary warfare, low-intensity conflict. You know, this is a cultural issue with the United States Army. It prides itself on its ability to fight and win big, large unit, high intensity wars. And the Army has to shift and adjust in this century, at least in the near term future, because the kind of wars we're liable to be fighting are not those kind. And this was one of the lessons and one of the messages in Baghdad at sunrise, that we need to come to grips with this because it's not going to go away. However much we might wish to fight the kind of wars that we want to fight, the quick regime change over in a matter of weeks and come home to the victory parades, that's not the way it's likely to be, at least in the foreseeable future.
One of the other themes that I noticed throughout the book was you're having to write about the loss of military personnel. And I'm wondering, you mentioned a number of them, some people that had been killed in various ways. Was that, as you were writing about it, one of the more difficult parts?
I did my best to mention everyone in my brigade who died. There were 24 of them. and to discuss the circumstances surrounding their deaths and the to show their bravery and their devotion to duty, in which they all, you know, despite the manner in which they all died doing their duty, and many of them exhibiting signs of bravery in the process. It's important for the families, and it's important for the American people to see that these are American citizens standing up, what I call in the final chapter, the America's newest, greatest generation, which is willing to stand up for what it believes in and sacrifice in order to achieve it. Probably the most difficult part of the book, though, to write was the 8 pages in the chapter entitled Automia, where I discussed the death of my Sergeant Major, Sergeant Major Eric Cook, who was a close confidant and a very good friend. We lived right next to each other for 5 months or so leading into the operation in which he was killed. And, you know, I had to come to grips with the mistakes I made that night, and the mistakes others had made, and, you know, the manner in which he died. And it was very difficult. It was a very difficult time for the brigade. To have one of its senior leaders killed. And so that was by far the hardest part of the book to write. And it was also probably the most cathartic experience in writing the book.
Mm-hmm. Was there a part that flew off the pages really easily? You said that was, you know, maybe the beginning of it when you're talking about your childhood and things like that. Stories that I think a lot of people like to tell.
Actually, that went pretty quick. And then, mm-hmm. there, you know, you might think otherwise, but the final chapter, Reflections, also mm-hmm. flew off the pen because I had so many ideas I'd been thinking about for a while that they linked together pretty easily, mm-hmm. and that was a pretty easy chapter to write. The part in terms of my family history and my personal history was one of the funnest parts to write. It was you know, trip down memory lane. Many of the experiences were positive, and mm-hmm. So it was fun to think back and write about my childhood and whatnot. Mm-hmm.
How did writing this memoir differ from, say, writing your dissertation, what later became 1999's book, The GI Offensive in Europe, The Triumph of American Infantry Divisions, 1941-45?
The big difference was the amount of research I had to do to compile the book. The GI Offensive in Europe was an outgrowth of my dissertation, greatly expanded and revised, but it is chocked full of footnotes that document where the sources are from, many of them from archival sources. For Baghdad at Sunrise, most of the sources were close at hand. I either had them in my personal possession, they were in electronic format, they were in my journals, and the rest of the sources in terms of finding out what the media had written that year, for instance, I could get off the internet. So the mm-hmm. the research for Baghdad at Sunrise was way easier. And that made it a much quicker process. From the time I started researching the GI Offensive in Europe in the summer of 1991, it was 8 years before it was published. Mm-hmm. I started writing Baghdad at Sunrise in 2005, and it was published in 2008, so quicker by half at least.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm curious, did you have to forego some of the writing habits you learned in the academy to learn new ones for this kind of book? For example, you include personal details in the book, things about your life, like the Michigan-Ohio State game, that I, you know, were not in the other one. It was a different kind of writing, more memoir.
Exactly. It's hard for me, a historian who writes prose that's chocked full of footnotes and it's, you know, a very academic style, if you will. I had to really work hard to force myself to put in personal stories and talk about feelings and talk about what people looked like and all the standard tradecraft for a fiction writer, which is not standard for a nonfiction writer. And, you know, I think I succeeded somewhat in that regard, but I can get much better. But it doesn't come naturally to me. Okay. You know, at some point, I'd love to write historical fiction, for instance. But to do it, I'd have to really revamp my writing style and be able to put in those kind of details.
But what are you hoping, or what do you imagine that military historians will get out of your book? How will they regard it? What are your hopes for it? What do you...
If you look back on, say, the history of the U.S.-Philippine War at the turn of the 20th century, there was a it had kind of the same progression of memoirs that came out of that conflict. First, the guys like Commodore Dewey, you know, right, the big guys, they write their memoirs. And then you have some of the really lower-level guys, the soldiers and the officers at the very lowest levels writing their accounts. And that middle tier, the middle managers, the middle leaders of the war, in this case, brigade combat team commanders, back in that case, perhaps the same rank colonels who were in charge of various units. It took a while for those kind of memoirs to come out. And but once they did, they filled a really key gap in the history of the war from, you know, there I was in the jungles and it was hot and it was humid and, you know, the Moros were a vicious enemy, to Commodore Dewey saying, yes, I sailed into Manila Bay, sunk the Spanish fleet, conquered, and went home. But in between are the folks that really shaped the war effort. And this, Baghdad at Sunrise, is the first book that is part of that middle tier. Not there I was on the streets of Baghdad, and it was hot and dusty, and the people spoke a strange language, or the upper tier, Jerry Bremer's My War, My Year in Iraq, and Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez's memoirs, and mm-hmm. those. But this is the first one at the brigade combat team level that says, here's what the strategy was, here's how it was implemented through folks above me and the orders I received, here's what it was like on the streets, and this is how I tried to bring it all together. And I think it's a really crucial piece of the war, history of the war, that you know, will be amplified, hopefully, by other books in the future.
Okay. Given the long and complicated history of the region around Iraq, how did you balance the historical background with your storytelling? I mean, when you're going through this book, there are moments where you'll take a couple of paragraphs or something to describe, you know, this is the background of this this religious conflict, this is the background of that, this is a lot of stuff about the area, the Sunni-Shiite split, things like that. What I suspect that area holds immense personal and professional fascination for you. It must have been tempting to hold back details. How did you deal with that?
Well, not really. I am half Palestinian, so Ana Housley Min Ramallah. My family is from Ramallah in the West Bank. And I wanted to present that history, the history of how my family came over to the United States, which is really interesting. But I didn't want to just lump it into one section. And the same with Iraqi history and Islamic history. It's really important to understand it, to understand the background of the conflict. But I just want to take a chapter and say, okay, here's all the antecedents to what was going on. Mm-hmm. So what I decided to do to make the book more readable and more enjoyable is to break up both the family history, the Iraqi history, the Islamic history, into manageable chunks and insert it into the manuscript where it made sense to do so. So if we're talking about the pilgrimage to Karbala on a Shiite holiday, then I would backtrack and talk about, well, why does this holiday exist? Let's talk about the Battle of Karbala in the 7th century A.D. and talk about, you know, the Sunni-Shiite split at that point. And, you know, those were the kind of things that I'd interject, which I think makes the text more readable. Mm-hmm. And so every now and then you get a little detail of Iraqi history, Islamic history that lends itself to the background of what's going on and understanding why things happen the way they're happening.
You've written about World War II and the Iraq conflict or the Iraq War. What other military histories do you want to write? What's next on your plate?
Well, I've written about World War II in the European theater. So that my current research is focused on the U.S. Army in the Pacific War against Japan, which there hasn't been really a good one-volume book on Army operations in the Pacific, which, you know, they have 2 to 3 times the number of divisions in the Pacific than the Marines, and yet get about 1/10 the ink. So I'm gonna do that. That'll take a number of years, 4 to 5, I'd say. And then I haven't decided what I'm going to do after that, but I think I need another project after that that's not focused on Iraq. And then the one after that will be back to the Iraq War, and either a look at the surge or maybe a general history of the entire war. The problem with writing about Iraq now is the documents are still classified. And so all the books that are coming out are journalistic accounts based on interviews. And that's wonderful. That's maybe the first draft of history. But as a historian, you know, although I'm comfortable doing that, it really isn't conducive to my work as a historian. It's not part of the field, if you will. Mm-hmm. I think that I would be doing the public a much greater service by writing that first or maybe second draft of history, if you will, based on documentary sources, along with all the interviews, along with what's been published to date, and bring it all together. And that's going to take some time. It takes 10 years for a secret-level document to be declassified, which is why history isn't written real quickly.
History writing must be, I would think, going through a really interesting set of moments now, because so much more information is available, but it's so much more difficult, like many aspects of writing. You know, the internet gives a lot and creates a lot of other problems, but is there particularly unique problems to historical writing?
Absolutely. The problem today is all of the documents are electronic. Very few are being stored hard copy. And that makes it very, very difficult to catalog them as an archivist, to access them as a historian and as a researcher. And I'm really concerned that a lot of our history is being lost as a result. It's okay at the higher levels. You know, if the chairman of the Joint Chiefs writes a note to someone, that's all cataloged. The president, that's all cataloged. But 2- and 3-star generals and even 4-star generals, unless they're combatant commanders, colonels, all that email traffic flowing back and forth, it's just not kept. Where if I'm studying the history of a division in World War II, they kept everything. And then they sent it to the National Archives. And so there's boxes and boxes and boxes of this stuff. You can go through all their operations reports and whatnot. And that's the stuff that I'm afraid is being lost. Now, there are efforts to capture it. U.S. Army Center for Military History and U.S. Marine Corps Historical Center and so forth. We just have to see how good their efforts are. I'm afraid they're under-resourced and underfunded, but we'll find out in future years. And
now I'd like to just shift over to a couple of short answers and let you rest your voice. I know you have a cold, and I want to thank you again for coming in today when you're not feeling well, sitting under the hot lights in what is not the coolest room in the world, but certainly much cooler than Iraq.
Yeah, is winter compared to Iraq. We're good.
So what's the best part about being a writer?
I love writing books, and I think that the best part of being a writer is seeing your book published, knowing that you've made a contribution to human knowledge, and you've given a gift to future generations that will outlive you. And that's really important to me. I think it's one of the defining features of, you know, my life. It's what drives me.
Okay. What's the worst part about being a writer?
I think writer's block. Everyone gets it every now and then. Mm-hmm. And when you get it, it's really hard to work through.
Sounds like a virus.
Yeah, almost, yeah. I've developed a few ways to get over it. One is you just leave that section and go off and write something else that might flow more naturally. Mm-hmm. Or you just take a break and go work out, or at the farthest extreme, take a vacation, because just sitting there staring at a computer screen for hours isn't going to get it done.
Yeah. What's the worst writing job you've had, the one that was the most difficult to face?
I think that any of the kind of staff writing I had to do as a military officer, especially these large unit training plans, annual training plans and so forth, they're just drudgery. And you dread doing them, and they tend to be book length in the amount of material, without any of the kind of intrinsic benefits of having done it at the end.
What's the best writing job?
Well, again, I think that I don't consider writing a job, for one thing. I up to this point in my life, I didn't get paid to write. Except the staff work I did wrote on nights and weekends and in my free time. And mm-hmm. family vacations were to places where you could access archives and so forth. So it's more of a pleasure than a job. But again, I very much prefer writing books to articles. I think they're longer lived. There's more of a value, personal value, to see my books on the shelves and see other people reading them. So that would be the best.
Okay. Earlier you mentioned military fiction that you were thinking. What other genre haven't you written that you'd like to try?
Well, that would be it. Historical fiction. Right? I'd love to, say, write a historical fiction book about World War II or something like that. But again, I'd have to really retool my writing style to do it, and I don't see it in the near term, but yep. Who knows, maybe in my retirement years.
And I meant historical, not military. Sorry about that. What book is on your nightstand right now? What are you reading?
I'm actually doing a review of David Kilcullen's The Accidental Guerrilla, in which mm-hmm. he discusses the global war on terror and the strategy behind it, and really what drives various guerrilla groups around the world, various insurgent groups. And he has a very intricate way of parsing out who we're fighting, and I think it's an important book. Difficult to read because he is an academic like me. He has a PhD in anthropology and has been there and done that in terms of counterinsurgency warfare as well. Mm-hmm. But I'm working my way through it, and I think it's a really important book. So.
Okay. Who's your biggest influence as a writer? Who do you look back to or want to emulate?
The man with the red pen, Dr. Williamson Murray. Wick Murray is a good friend, very close friend now, but he was one of my two PhD advisors back from 90 to 92 here at Ohio State. He's no longer at the university. He's in D.C. now, but he really, more than anyone else, taught me how to write well. Okay. And going through 2 years worth of courses with him and suffering through his red pen on your papers time and again, you learn how to wring all the passive voice and dangling participles out of your writing.
Okay. What's your secret vice of an author or a genre? What would it surprise people that you read sometimes?
I don't know that it would surprise anyone, but I'm a real avid follower of science fiction.
Oh, okay.
I think Starship Troopers, I just listed it in a magazine or a newspaper recently as one of my five top books of all time, which I think it is. I love reading, Star Trek novels and whatnot. It's the kind of thing I do to relax.
Have you seen the movies for Starship Troopers or Star Trek? Is that something you're also interested in, or are you primarily a reader?
Yeah, every one of them.
Okay.
And some are better than others. I thought, by the way, the very newest Star Trek movie is one of the best.
Mm-hmm.
Probably second still to The Wrath of Khan, which is one of my favorites.
Yeah.
Starship Trooper movies are entertaining, but they're not quite as good in that regard, especially mm-hmm. the made-for-video ones that came out. But they're still fun to watch. You know?
Oh, there was another one after, because I kind of remember
there were
that.
Two more. There's three total. Two of them went right to DVD.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you very much for coming in and talking to us today. Again, the book is Baghdad at Sunrise, and it's available at all fine bookstores on Amazon and many other places. So thank you very much, and have a great day.
Thanks. Pleasure to be here.